Take my word for it. Every concession we make to labor in this plant's a mistake. Don't give an inch. Not a single inch.
Don't forget it, you guys. There's only one way to handle management around here. If the union expects to get anywhere, don't concede a thing. Not a single thing.
Raising its radio mirror high above the arena occupied by labor and management, Living 1949 finds reflected in it this Labor Day week a happier hope for industrial harmony than the extremes you've just heard. A little later, we'll tell you how to secure an 8-page pamphlet explaining why. Meanwhile, from the files of the National Planning Association's Committee on the Causes of Industrial Peace, we bring you now actual case histories of how today, in plants scattered the nation over,
they wage the peace.
Your narrator, Ken Banghart.
Greetings, wage-earning and wage-paying America. Let's look behind the parade, behind the speeches, behind the last long fling at summer that colloquially passes for Labor Day. Let's look because few of our domestic problems on the home stretch of Living 1949 can match the basic importance of the relations of labor and management. For it's only through peace at home that we can function as a strong and stable power for the peace we want in the world. But what about these bedfellows upon whose compatibility so much of our future depends? Management, as an organized force, is as old as property and enterprise. Organized labor is comparatively new.
20 years ago, labor unions could count a membership of roughly 3 million. Since 1930, they have multiplied 5 times to a total of 15.5 million working men and women in 196 national unions. Today, 1 out of every 6 Americans over 21 years of age, almost 1 in every family, carries a union card.
Like corpuscles in the bloodstream of a nation, organized labor is at work in a vast variety of tasks. As skilled craftsmen, such as carpenters, printers, stonemasons, machinists, in the coal mines of Pennsylvania, the steel mills of Ohio, the auto factories of Michigan, the textile shops of New England and the South, on the nation's network of railroads, trucks, airlines, on newspapers, on the Hollywood movie lots, indeed within this very studio right now, as writer, director, actors, musicians. All believe union membership has brought them something.
Spending Saturday with my kids means a lot to me.
I don't feel helpless anymore. I feel like my say-so counts for something.
My dad was a mill worker, too. Why am I better off than he was? The union.
And while it would be foolish to deny that there persists, and strongly, much of the old feeling of suspicion and distrust, and sometimes even open conflict, still there is another side of the story. Listen.
In 1946... a record year for strikes, the lost working time due to strikes was less than 1.5% of all the time worked. And in 1947, well over 90% of the 100,000 collective bargaining contracts were renegotiated without any stoppage in work.
Well, if that's true, you ask, what's all the shouting about? Why haven't we heard more about this? Well, my friends, did you ever hear the saying, peaceful nations have no histories? It isn't peace that gets the publicity. It's the conflicts.
50,000 workers vote to strike.
Page one. But
contract renewed at consolidated without incident.
That gets buried in the warheads. Now, that fact, supported by the evidence, set some people thinking. One of them was that senior statesman of the American labor movement, Clinton Golden.
More coffee, Mr. Golden?
No, thanks. Look, Tom, let me put it this way. Ever since 1876, every 7 or 8 years, the government begins all over again investigating the causes of conflict and strikes in industry.
Well, what's wrong with that? We want to know, don't we?
Well, you don't get my point. What I'm getting at is that that's a negative approach to our problem. What we need is a positive approach.
For instance?
Well, if you want to find out what makes a successful marriage, you don't only study divorce cases. You also go ask those who've celebrated their golden anniversaries.
I see what you mean.
It's time that instead of looking into causes of industrial conflict, we ought to try to discover how much peace there is between labor and management, and what makes that peace.
Clinton Clinton Golden's startling idea was taken up by the National Planning Association, which appointed a committee of 29 labor and industry leaders and consultants with him as chairman, and began to probe into the causes not of war, but
the causes of industrial peace under collective bargaining.
What you will hear from here on out are actual examples of successful labor-management relations turned up by the NPA study. Incidents that concern real plants, real people, who, whether they know it or not, are the causes of industrial peace.
Yes, one common fact emerged from all our studies. Where we found good relations existing between labor and management, we always found the recognition of common interests, of a common goal, security. To the laborer, security meant one thing.
A steady job, good pay, people who treat you right.
To management, security meant another thing.
We want to be able to deliver good products at prices people are willing to pay.
But however stated, wherever there was industrial peace, it stemmed from this basic recognition of mutual interest. Well, listen and see if I'm not right.
Guidepost number one. Industrial peace is born of the common appreciation that mutual interests are greater than the differences.
To demonstrate what we mean by this first guidepost to industrial peace, we give you a plant in the clothing industry.
You want to know our story? It's not very exciting. In 29 years under collective bargaining, we haven't had a single strike, nor for 18 years a single case that went to arbitration. Believe me, we haven't done this by giving the business away in the form of unusually high wages. Our company and our union, when we meet to solve problems, not to win arguments.
Well, that's exciting enough for us. Go on.
We'll take back in the Depression, in the 30s. We were having a pretty hard time. The union knew it. In fact, they even negotiated two successive wage cuts just so we could stay on our feet. But in spite of everything, it suddenly began to look like we had a holdup. That's it, Sam. We've been to every commercial bank in the city and out of it. And they all refused to extend our credit. Without money, we can't operate. I thought the union ought to know.
Yeah, pretty tough.
Worse than that. Desperate.
Let me see. There's one bank you haven't been to, Joe.
Where?
The union.
What'd you say?
Us, the union. Maybe we can loan you the money.
Why, Sam,
Because we like the color of your eyes, understand. Purely business. Our members got families. Families need to eat. They can't eat if our men don't have jobs. If you fold up, bye-bye jobs. You need money to stay in business. We need you to stay in business. We're going to work.
Well, Sam, if that's how you feel...
We'll get you the money through a third wage cut. But don't forget it's a loan. Someday we expect you to pay it back.
We didn't shut down, thanks to that loan from the union. We weathered the Depression. And in 1937, we paid back the loan on the basis of 50 cents to the dollar. But if you really want to know what I mean by getting along, by understanding each other, by working in a kind of partnership, go sit in on Tony Santini.
Well, who's Tony Santini?
He's our plant chairman. One of the regular union employees elected by the other union members is a sort of middleman between them and us. He's worth so much to us, we'd like to pay him more, only the union won't let us. Go see Tony Santini if you want to see a union man that's a boon to management.
We went to see Tony Santini, who had worked in the clothing industry since he was 14. We found him in an office all his own. He was saying with a sigh,
I'd much rather be back on the job than listening to grievances all day.
But we hadn't been there long before we saw how much more Tony was worth both to the union and the management right where he is. A production supervisor and one of his employees stormed into the office.
Tony, can I see you right away? It's important.
Sure, Etcher. What cook?
This is Mary Webby, Tony. I want you to look at her work. Look at these lapels.
Sure, sure. How are the kids, Ed?
Oh, fine.
Good. Sit down, Mary. Sit down. This ain't so good, Mary.
I know.
You know what this operation is worth?
I'm sure you do. It's your piecework.
Yeah, I know. 1 cent a coat.
Check. But do you know how much it costs to correct each of these mistakes of yours?
No.
About 6 cents each. Now, look, Mary. The company can't afford for very long to pay you 1 cent to make mistakes and another 6 cents to have them fixed. Can it?
I guess not.
And leaving the company out of it, what about the other workers? When they have to take time to fix your bad work, it cuts into their own time and their earnings.
Well, I...
Well, now, what do you think we should do about this?
I'll tell you, Mr. Santini. I guess I'm just not cut out to sit at a machine all day long. After I've been sitting a while, my mind sort of slips off my work and goes somewhere else.
I see. Well, Ed, anything we can do about this?
Hey, she used to be a pretty good messenger when she first came here. Maybe we could shift her back.
How'd you like that, Mary?
Gee, that'd be fine.
Okay, consider it settled.
Thanks, Tony.
Wait a minute. Who we got to fill this job? We can't just leave this place empty, you know.
Well, there's Esther, one of the apprentices, but we won't be able to clear her for a few days.
Then, Mary, you've got to promise me personally that in the few days more you're going to be on the machine, you'll watch your work. See to it. What leaves your hand...
This spirit of partnership, this recognition of mutual interest to produce well and at a profit to both parties, in Tony Santini's office, it is a facet of industrial peace that is daily showing its face.
Guidepost number 2. Industrial peace comes from a sense of responsibility on both sides.
David Dubinsky, leader of the Garment Workers Union, brings this point down to earth in the following phrases.
In the old days, it was the class struggle, and to hell with the boss. Now, it's collaboration and concern about the industry.
Mr. Dubinsky might have added that it has to work both ways. Not only concern for the industry by its employees, but concern for its employees by the industry. One company in the steel industry shows this concern by an informal method of handling grievances while they're still minor, so as to head them off from becoming major grievances. Here's a case in point. A case from the files of the NPA committee exploring the causes of industrial peace.
It is late at night in the home of machinist Bill McLaughlin, a maintenance worker on the day shift. The phone rings.
Hello?
Hello, McLaughlin?
Yeah, right.
Listen, there's been a breakdown at the mill. We need you guys from the day shift right away to help out. It's an emergency.
Okay. As soon as I dress.
Hurry up, will you?
I can't even sleep.
Bill and his fellow machinists finish their repair job at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the wheels start turning again.
Okay, boys. You can go home now. We'll be back in time for the 8 o'clock shift.
What do you mean, go home? You know on jobs like this, we stay at the mill till we go on our shift. Otherwise, we'll get docked for the time we go home.
Just see here, boys.
I'm not going home. I'm staying right here.
Okay, stay if you want to. But you're on your own time.
You bet we'll see. We'll see Mr. Wheeler the minute he gets in.
They saw me, all right. In fact, they were waiting for me when I got into the plant at 8 o'clock.
You are listening to the actual words of the Industrial Relations Director, Bill's Mr. Wheeler.
You see, I always get in at 8, so I'll be here if grievances or problems come up on the night shift. They can be taken up with me if necessary before the people involved leave the mill.
The men took their grievance to Mr. Wheeler the same day. He assured them they would receive full pay for the time spent in the mill, including the hours from 4 to 8 that morning, thus bypassing the formal grievance procedure. A hard-headed reason?
I find that this stops a minor incident from mushrooming into undue proportions and causing us trouble.
And that's how this management, by the prompt settlement of disagreements between its representatives and employees, assumes its responsibility toward its workers and makes for peace. Have workers proved themselves equally responsible? Where there's a long record of industrial peace, yes. And to prove the point, we introduce you now to a new scene, a paper mill that for 14 years has not had a single day's interruption of work.
I belong to the union committee at this mill. One day we were called over to the main office to talk over an inspection problem. Mr. Taylor, the mill super, didn't waste any time getting to the point.
Well,
It's about the paperback department, boys. Not good.
What's trouble, Mr. Taylor?
We're getting complaints. Customers complain one after another. The paper bags we're putting out aren't what they should be. Too often our customers are getting stuff that isn't fit to be called a paper bag.
Okay, so you got inspectors, Mr. Taylor. What's wrong with the inspectors?
A good question. And that's exactly what I want to know. Now, we've all got a stake in putting out good paper bags, or we aren't going to sell paper bags and a lot of jobs are going down the drain. Now, look, those inspectors belong to your union. They might speak more frankly to you than they would to me. What about it?
This way, Joe. You're one of the oldest inspectors in the plant. We told Mr. Taylor we'd get the lowdown on these paper bags. Now, let's have it.
Now, look, guys, of course we inspectors know those bags ain't what they ought to be. But what do you want us to do? Squeal on another member of the union? Say he ain't doing his work right and get him fired?
We went back to the boss, the whole committee. We told him straight, just like he put it to us. No bones.
Well, how about it? We've got to lick it somehow. Any suggestions?
Well, I got one. May sound funny coming from my side of the table, but you want my opinion, those inspectors don't belong in a union.
You mean, really management?
That's right. Yeah, take the inspectors out of the union and put them on a management staff.
Yeah, and make them responsible to your office for quality.
Thanks, boys. I see it that way, too. But will the union stand for it?
We done well better, Mr. Taylor, for the good of all of us.
Thus did the union, fully aware of the difficulty, recognize its duty to management and act in a responsible manner by voluntarily relinquishing jurisdiction over some of its members. Remember Dubinsky?
In the old days, it was a class struggle and to hell with the boss. Now, it's collaboration and a concern about the industry.
A sense of responsibility on both sides. Guidepost 2 for industrial peace.
Guidepost number 3. Recognition that employees are adults and that they can't be treated like children, no matter how well-intentioned may be the fatherly impulses of the boss.
So for a case study that shows labor peace is not necessarily synonymous with healthy industrial relations, a story of how well-meaning paternalism on the part of the president of a company did not provide the employee gratitude and goodwill that he expected to lead to high production and sound relations, whereas collective bargaining did.
I remember the day like it was yesterday, the day I inherited the business from Dad, just fresh out of Harvard with an engineering degree. I was full of ideas, good ideas, I thought. And the biggest one of all was I didn't want the men to feel about me like they felt about my dad.
The old goat.
That's what they called him, I knew. And I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to like me not for any personal, vain reason, but because I thought it would be good for the factory. So the first thing I did when I planted myself behind Dad's old desk...
Yes, Mr. Howard?
Miss Frost, if any of the men have a complaint and want to see me, I want you to be sure to show them in, huh? I want them to know that the door is always open.
Yes, Mr. Howard.
Then I leaned back, lit a cigar, very pleased with myself. As far as I was concerned, that was the way to get good employee relations. The men soon found I was a willing listener.
It's our supervisor, Mr. Howard. He's pushing us, all the time pushing us, like we was machines or something, not human beings. Now, I work for your father, and I want to work for you. Only my health can't stand it.
What's your supervisor's name?
Williams. Edgar Williams.
Well, don't you worry, old man. I'll look right into it. Miss Frost, have Ed Williams come in to see me right away.
See me, Mr. Howard?
Williams, I don't know whether you've been told or not, but there's a new deal on in this place. I want my men treated fairly. I understand you've been pushing them pretty hard.
Bunk. Working just as they always have for your father. The trouble, Mr. Howard, if you don't mind my speaking frankly, is that they're on to you. I don't know if you've been told, but they're calling you a soft touch. Soft touch Howard.
That'll do, Williams.
But it's true. We can't manage them if they're going to be running to you all the time. We've got to be given the
authority. I said that'll do. Williams, apparently you're not in sympathy with the new management around here. And I got rid of Williams. I didn't think his attitude was right. I went on trying to carry the ball my own way. Oh, I dealt with them severely when I thought I had to. A member there was Peterson.
But I'm entitled to that job, Mr. Howard. I'm next in line.
Now, don't argue with me, Peterson. I know what's best for you. You stay where you are.
But, Mr. Howard, I...
Yes, I was firm when I had to be. But I thought my methods were working. The business was prospering. Some of my board members raised an eyebrow at my tactics now and then, but I felt confident and sure. And then, just when I thought everything was going all right, I woke up one day to find...
They've joined a union.
What?
They've unionized, and behind your back.
Well, but they can't do that to me. Why, I've always treated them like my own family. Why did they do it to me? The first thing I did when I was alone was to call Mike Doyle, an old, experienced labor man I knew. Why, I'm a liberal, Mike. Why did they do that to me?
Well, tell you, Mr. Howard, I guess it's just that the men feel they're grown up, not children. They want the privileges and responsibilities of adulthood.
Well, is the union going to do that for them?
They must think so, or they wouldn't have joined. Now look, Mr. Howard, the union won't interfere with your workers. Just remember, it's up to you how good a union you have.
Having a union didn't seem to clarify anything. As far as I could see, instead of being bothered by petty demands, I got stronger demands from a united group. And then I began to see what my mistakes had been. I had bypassed my middle and lower management so long that they didn't know how to deal with the union. Negotiations became all give for management and no take by the union. So I had to deal with the union myself. Again, I got the advice I needed from the strangest place, union man Mike Doyle.
You're being imposed upon, Mr. Howard.
Well, that's what my management tells me.
In this case, they're talking turkey. Stand up for your rights a bit more. It's no one-way street, collective bargaining, and you won't be here forever. Delegate some of your authority, my friend.
Well, that was about December 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor, war. I was called to Washington to work for the government. Away from my workers, I had to delegate authority. My delegates had to learn to make their authority stick. The union had to learn it was responsible for some things, too. It took over enforcing the safety rules, for instance. When it was all over, and I got back, I found what I'd always hoped for and never got when I tried to be a papa to everybody myself.
The union's got no complaints, Mr. Howard.
The board hasn't a real thing to kick about, Jeff.
And production is staying up. No, they're not calling me old soft touch anymore. Just the boss. A tough bargainer who doesn't coddle his men, but lives up to his side of the bargain.
Recognition that employees are grown up. A sense of responsibility on both sides, encouraging management by consultation. Appreciation of the fact that labor and management's common goals are greater than their differences. All of these guideposts to industrial peace point up that one basic principle mentioned earlier. Namely,
industrial peace stems from the recognition of mutual interests.
How fresh is the story Mr. Golden is talking about? As alive as the current news. The ink is scarcely dry on the newspapers which this week announced action by the unionized employees of one of the nation's great department stores. Yes, through their union, the men and women of Wanamaker's in New York are going to finance an advertising campaign to build public goodwill for the store in which they work. A recognition by labor that it shares with management both the benefits of as well as the responsibility for the good health of their mutual venture. Where that principle has been recognized by both labor and management, where the implications that branch from it have been put into practice by both labor and management, the change has been remarkable. Too often, bargaining used to occur in an atmosphere like this.
Real nice of you to consent to see us, Mr. Brown.
Don't bring in any extra chairs, Miss Tanner. They won't be here that long.
Today, you're more likely to find labor and management talking like this.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Brown. We know you're busy.
Oh, that's all right. We're all in the same boat. What's on your mind, boys?
Thus, we can see that industrial peace can be won. Not by suspicion, not by lawyers with bulging briefcases, not by management and labor sitting down together as the lion with the lamb, but as equals fired with a willingness to work together for the common good. For your information, here are the companies and the unions from whom we've drawn our examples.
The Crown Zellerbach Corporation and the Pacific Coast Pulp and Paper Industry, of which Crown Zellerbach is a part. The International Brotherhood of Pulp, Sulfite, and Paper Mill Workers. The International Brotherhood of Paper Makers.
The Libby Owens Ford Glass Company. The Federation of Glass Ceramic and Silica Sand Workers of America.
The Dewey and Almy Chemical Company. The International Chemical Workers Union.
The Hickey Freeman Company. The Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America.
The Sharon Steel Corporation. The United Steel Workers of America.
You can receive an 8-page brochure free, entitled A Positive Approach to Industrial Peace, based upon the experiences of these companies and these unions. Simply write, a postcard will do, to Living, NBC, New York 20, New York. Living, NBC, New York 20, New York, for the booklet on industrial peace. But if you would see an example of how these companies and unions are succeeding, go look in Crown Zellerbach's Goldfish Bowl.
He's not kidding you. The Goldfish Bowl is what we call a glass-walled room where we hold our annual negotiating session in Portland. So as union leaders and mill managers both can see and hear what's going on and learn more about collective bargaining.
Or go down to Hickey Freeman's union headquarters and ask to look at their written contract.
The contract? Let me see now. Say, you know, I don't believe there's a copy in the whole joint. Wait a minute. Miss Murphy, do you know where I can put my hands on a copy of our contract with Hickey Freeman?
Need we tell you, America, that...
If two such giants as labor and management engage in a struggle for dominance within the delicate mechanism of the American economy, neither can win, and democracy is bound to lose. They will all go down together in chaos, or in the regimentation which will arrive from public demand to avoid chaos.
But if we in labor, and we in management, truly work together, build a new framework of human relations on broad cooperative lines, if we succeed in attaining this goal, then
we have the overall plant organization, the managerial techniques, the skilled labor force, the raw materials, the technology, and the market to usher in a period of unprecedented and sustained prosperity.
Well, might we ponder then, as Labor Day passes another anniversary, this thought, indeed, this warning from the chairman of the National Labor Relations Board.
Free collective bargaining between relative equals offers the best hope, the last best hope, perhaps, for a 20th century society to escape the blight of totalitarianism, either from the left or the right.
Remember, if you would know more of how American labor and management is waging the peace, write to Living, NBC, New York 20, New York, for the 8-page brochure based on the National Planning Association's 5 case studies entitled A Positive Approach to Industrial Peace. Once again, for this informative booklet securing industrial peace, write Living, NBC, New York 20, New York. A postcard will do. With this program, Living 1949 comes to the end of its current season. As we leave the air, we hope our listeners will want to watch for the resumption of our series over many of these same stations during the week of October 23rd. We suggest that you watch your own papers for day, time, and station. Living 1949 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Scripts are written by Lou Hazem, music is conducted by Roy Shield, and your narrator today was Ken Banghart. The program is directed by Jack Cuney. Starting tonight, the Pet Milk Show will be heard on Sundays. Yes, starting tonight, you'll hear the Pet Milk Show at a new time. Listen, won't you, when Larry Douglas and Kay Armon sing your favorite tunes on the Pet Milk Show. Fred Collins speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.